I'm Aaron Rothstein of the Ethics and Public Policy Center's Bioethics and American Democracy Program. Welcome to Searching for Medicine's Soul. Today's guest is Dasha Kuiper. She is the former consulting clinical director of support groups at an Alzheimer's organization and has an MA in clinical psychology from Columbia University. She's worked with both dementia patients and caregivers. She's the author of Travelers to Unimaginable Lands, Stories of Dementia, the Caregiver, and the Human Brain. Dasha, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I wanted to give just maybe a bit of background for our listeners and the context in which your book was written. Dementia is a brutal disease and in some ways a chronic one. It's not just a problem with memory loss, though it primarily involves that. It also can lead to personality changes, agitation, bouts of physical violence, disruption of sleep-wake cycles, loss of language, among other symptoms. And because the debilitating nature of the disease nearly always requires round-the-clock care eventually. The World Health Organization estimates that the number of individuals with dementia worldwide is approximately 55 million, with this number expected to reach 78 million by 2030 and 139 million by 2050. The global financial burden of dementia was estimated to be $1.3 trillion in 2019 and may rise to $2.8 trillion by 2030. So when we think about dementia from a medical perspective, we tend to think primarily about the patients. Are there resources for the patients? Are there treatments for the patients? What can we do for the patients? And all that is noble and important and kind of what we are trained to do in school. But I and many others often have a blind spot for what this diagnosis means for caregivers. What does it mean to be a caregiver for a dementia patient? And how did you come to focus on this aspect of the disease?
Well, I came to focus on this aspect of the disease because I became a caregiver in my mid-20s when I was taking a break from academia. And I think I came into it, like you said, you know, really concentrating on the person who had the dementia disorder and thinking that he was the one who was going to have the real struggle, right? Everybody else was just going to be sad around him. But what I found to my surprise that the caregiver, his son, and myself were just as in many ways, not just emotionally grieving and disoriented, but also cognitively disoriented by what was going on. And I noticed that the changes that were happening were not just happening to the person with the disease, but to all of us. It made me really rethink how we look at brain diseases. And that's what made me really want to work with caregivers, because I thought their brain and what's happening to them is just as fascinating and just as revealing and just as torturous oftentimes as the person who has the illness.
Throughout the book and in your own experience and in my anecdotal observations as well, there's a constant and unremitting temptation to argue with patients with dementia, to try to get them to recognize that they're ill, that they need help, and they should, you know, stop driving, and you know, it's almost chastising them in some way for like repeating the same things over and over. So why do we feel the need to engage in these kinds of arguments? What does it say about us, the ones who are supposed to be of like sound, use that in air quotes, mind? What have you noticed in your practice?
Oh gosh, I think almost every chapter hits on that theme of like, there are so many different reasons for why we argue. And part of the reason I wanted to write this book is to really normalize the fact that if you're a caregiver, I mean, you know, you're not supposed to, but you're going to. And the reason is that we know that it's reasonable not to. But the more I learned about the mind and the more research I did, the more I realized that the human mind really, our priority, especially when we feel our relationships falling apart, is really not to be reasonable. It's not what our brain's top priority is. It's to seek social connection. And oftentimes it's our desperation and our own brains falling apart that makes us argue, because these symptoms, they seem just very clear-cut and neurological, but the way that our brain interprets these symptoms when we're dealing with somebody who we feel close to, who we love, is it feels like we're losing connection. So for example, if your husband has hallucinations, no, those hallucinations seem clear cut. You can't argue with somebody who has hallucinations, right? They're not going to abide by the truth. And it seems straightforward, but how our social brain interprets their hallucinations is that we're no longer sharing in the same reality. And that's deeply painful for us. And what do? We begin to scramble by wanting to gain that mutual reality that we're losing. And so what happens is that we argue not because we're being mean, but because we really want to once again share in the same world, because that's what our social minds are built for. And this disease is almost a ruthless, relentless reminder that no, you don't get to live in the same world anymore. And so oftentimes it leaves us scrambling and disoriented because we so desperately want to come back to it, not necessarily because we are in denial, but because we're just not built to live in these isolated worlds.
What do you tell your patients about this? Like, how do you sort of help them deal with this very primal temptation?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of dark humor, and a lot of the times it's in support groups. I think that a lot of times people think, oh, these therapy settings, it's a lot of weeping and a lot of, and there is a lot of grief, but a lot of it is this kind of quiet admission of all the ridiculous things that you argued with your parents or your spouse or your siblings or your friends about when you know you shouldn't. And I think that the first step is to really normalize the fact that this is going to happen. I don't go into the brain science with my, with my clients, but I do say to them, I really try to repeat to them, I have not met a caregiver that doesn't have this temptation. I have not met a caregiver who hasn't eventually succumbed to it. And I explain to them how normal it is. And I try to remind them of all the things that they're doing right, because being a caregiver is dealing with incredible guilt. Because again, our expectations of the quote unquote sound mind is that we're going to act rationally. So when all caregivers find themselves tempted, reacting irrationally, angrily, there's so much guilt. So my priority is to really explain to them, no, this is bound to happen. And there are many things you are doing correctly, because you're usually haunted by the things that you're not doing right.
Yeah. I think, you know, reading your book, I was thinking to myself, this seems to be a much more difficult thing, caring for a dementia patient, particularly as they advance, than someone who is, you know, it's all relative, so I don't want to be absolute about this, than someone who is, say, like debilitated from cancer or another sort of what we call like medical disease, because I think it's so much harder to grasp what we're dealing with and to be grounded in reality when like the like we can see the physical things, but it's so much harder when we can't see. And the neurological diseases are things that we can't really see. I don't know if that makes sense to you or how you think about that.
It makes perfect sense. I'm so glad you said that. Absolutely. And in fact, the research bears it out, because we see that dementia caregivers, as opposed to other caregivers, suffer greater physical and mental burnout and actually spend more hours, because essentially you are constantly making, part of being a caregiver for somebody who has dementia is actually constantly making decisions and functioning for two, essentially. And I think it is, in my book, I point out the fact that it is a lot more complicated than dealing with somebody who has cancer, which is not to take the extreme grief and challenge of caregiving for somebody who has cancer. But I do think that that is something our brains can understand, because the person and their disease are separate entities. You could commiserate with a person, right? You could still share in that world with the person who has, with the person who has cancer. You're both in it together. But with a person who has dementia, I think that one of the reasons it's so challenging, both emotionally and cognitively, is you are not able to grieve with them. And I think that part of the reason that caregivers oftentimes argue and they go, no, it's because you have dementia, is because they're actually trying to be a team. Right? They're trying to say it's us against this disease, but the disease is part of who they are. It's not all of who they are, but it is, there's no demarcation between the disease and the person. And so it creates so many complications, and it really takes away from our human desire to share in the struggle, because human minds could deal with a lot of challenges, but one of the things they really can't is not being able to share in that challenge, because our brains are really meant to deal with stress together rather than isolation. And that's how caregivers oftentimes end up falling apart, because there's nobody to commiserate with. There's no one to share that burden with. And in fact, part of the burden is, how much do I tell them? Do I defer to them on this? Do I have to override their decisions on that? So there are just so many ethical, emotional, and cognitive challenges that come with caregiving for somebody who has dementia.
One of the interesting things you discuss in the book is how the, and this sort of relates to what we're talking about, how the behavior of dementia patients often reinforces our conception of them as fully cognizant and self-aware human beings. You write, because memory is biased toward pre-existing knowledge, we all edit the present to make it look like the past. Thus, both patients and caregivers' biases collaborate to make the disease seem less pervasive than it really is. Can you elaborate on this a bit? What do you mean here?
Sure. Well, you know, we could use in this chapter, this is from a chapter where I refer to Sam as the caregiver, and how if a doctor or any outsider was to look at his father, who has memory loss, they would say, you know, this is very clear sign of memory loss. But what happens is that these symptoms of memory loss are very, very personal to the caregiver. So if a person who has dementia tells the caregiver, you never visit me, you know, on the one hand, you could say, oh, that's memory loss. But the thing is our mind tends to interpret the present to fit with the past, because that's what our minds do. We look at the world through the eyes of our previous expectations. And if your father was always complaining that you don't do enough, or if your father was always undermining you, or if your father was always, arguing with you, then the memory loss actually looks a lot like the usual complaints that he usually has against you. So, and caregivers get that all the time when folks who have dementia, their memory loss actually oftentimes encourages these kind of family patterns, where in this case, Mr. Kessler would undermine Sam because he doesn't remember, but Sam was used to his father's undermining. So it's very, very hard to say, well, is that memory loss, or is that, you know, my father always undermining my authority, or always thinking that he's right? So in fact, memory loss is a great ally for somebody who is very dismissive. And so it's very easy to tease these things apart. And because our family dynamics are old, but dementia is relatively new, it's very hard to switch from our usual family patterns into this new thing. It's not what we do. It's very hard to adapt and to change, especially during times of stress, which dementia disorders certainly are. Hmm.
Do you think that dementia can amplify the prior personality challenges, or do you think it is its own entity, and because people have had conflict with their, you know, loved ones in the past, that is the reason that it creates problems, because the problems are already there? I don't know if I'm making my distinction clear.
No, that makes a lot of sense, because if I understand it, it's like how much are we seeing this pattern, even if it doesn't exist and it's truly just the dementia? That is a really good question. And I think that none of us will truly know for sure. And of course, I know that you've seen this, and with everybody who has dementia, you know, it's so varied, right? Because there are so many different manifestations of this disease. So it's quite varied. But I think that it does, despite our brain's proclivity to kind of see what's happening in the light of the past, I also think that what's happening to the person who has dementia is that their brain is experiencing stress. Now, they might not consciously have the insight all the time to say, yes, I have this disease, but they are stressed out by it. And I think that the way that we deal with stress, a lot of our coping mechanisms are oftentimes how we've always dealt with stress. And so I do think that there are ways in which people become exaggerated. And because dementia puts you in a kind of a heightened sense of stress and danger, the nuances of your personality are erased, and you become in some ways an exaggeration of yourself, because you're always reaching to those defense mechanisms. And oftentimes, you know, and because you have less cognitive capacity, you are, I think, in many ways resorting to some of the most ingrained aspects of your coping mechanisms and your temperament and everything else that has to do with your identity. So, and that's what the caregivers are hearing they're hearing this person oftentimes deal with stress the way that they've always seen them deal with stress. So it's a collaboration between the person who has the disease and the caregiver.
And this always seems to reveal a profound anger amongst caregivers. I mean, every example in the book, you can tell that they're not just sad, they're angry. And that anger is directed in many different places, but very often towards their loved one. How do you suggest caregivers deal with that anger, which can be so hard to control?
Yeah, I think that, I will say that the majority of caregivers I speak to, eventually, if they feel honest enough, they do express that anger. Immediately, you might not get it. Sometimes it takes people a little while because it's so socially frowned upon. You know, we accept grief very easily. Anger feels a lot less palatable for caregivers to express. But yes, I do think that the majority of them do feel quite a bit of anger. And I feel that my job is actually not to manage that anger, but to understand it. And so I never think that my job is to make caregivers better caregivers, more patient, more loving, more understanding. I think that my job is to truly actually befriend their anger and to let they feel such shame about their anger and such guilt. I think that it's very important that they understand it and they feel sympathetic towards their own anger. It might feel like this alien thing that you hate and makes you feel guilty. But the more we allow caregivers room to have compassion for that anger and to explain to them that this is a very natural thing that you would be feeling. A lot of caregivers are caring for somebody that they might love, but they don't like, that they might have a very troubled history with, that there's abuse, that there's emotional abuse, physical abuse, that there's neglect. There's so many things that decades of experience you had with this person. And it requires so much sacrifice. And it is so disorienting dealing with this disease that I really try to really have them see the compassion for their anger that I have. And I feel like, ironically, that the less, if we don't push away the anger and don't try to reframe it, but really befriend it, so to speak, I think the calmer the caregiver feels, because part of that anger that the caregiver feels is, again, what we go back to is not being seen. Because as soon as somebody has dementia, it's very hard for the person with the disease to validate you, right? You're not sharing in the same experience. It's not cancer. So they feel all alone. So I feel that in my work, if I could make them feel truly understood and seen, then some of that tension actually goes away. And that naturally lowers the anger. So it's an indirect way of getting to it. But my goal is really to get caregivers to have compassion for themselves, because that's very reciprocal. The more compassion you have for yourself, the more you can have it for others as well.
You write, when we think of Alzheimer's, we usually think of it as erasing the self. But what happens in most cases is that the self splinters into different selves. Some we recognize, others we don't. Can you expand on this a little bit? Maybe give us an example of what you mean.
Yeah. In chapter four, I think that this is the line is from chapter four, we're introduced to a caregiver who I call Elizabeth, and her husband, who I call Mitch. And Mitch is, when you have dementia, the husband that she knows and loves deeply doesn't go away. He's charming, he's funny, and he completely adores her. That part is still there. But there's another part, which is a man who thinks that who during certain hours of the day thinks his wife is an imposter and kicks her out of the house. That part is still there too. And so I think that the way that dementia is oftentimes depicted in the media is this very passive, very lost person whose self is just being diminished. But what caregivers are dealing with is actually something a lot worse, and that is dealing with the ambiguity where sometimes that person does feel that person is gone and you can't access them. But then an hour later, your husband who you adore, who makes you laugh, comes back and he's still making you laugh and he's still being kind and sweet. And viscerally, in some ways, you still feel the same around him. So caregivers, part of the difficulty is they're dealing with a lot of different selves from the person they're taking care of. And it puts you in this horrible position of like, well, who is this person? And that's actually part of another reason why we argue, because if her husband was always delusional, if her husband always acted like somebody who had dementia, then I think she would stop arguing with him because then things would be very clear in her brain. But if her husband is the same sweet, funny guy she always knew an hour later, it's very easy to argue because then you think, oh, that person is capable of coming back to me. That person is capable of some reason. And so I think that's another reason that caregivers have a very hard time adapting because they're introduced to so many different selves and your hopes are constantly raised and you're like, oh no, we do have this connection. It's there. Oh wait, no, it's disappeared again. So it's a very ambiguous place to live.
That push and pull mimics an abusive relationship in some way, which, I mean, you know, so we tell, you know, people in an abusive relationship, you got to get out of the relationship. But in this case, it is, I mean, I don't know what to call it, but it's not being done purposefully. It's not being done by someone who's all there. And I'm not sure what to make of that, but it's just an observation.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you're making this observation. And that's what I actually try to tell caregivers. Again, I don't try to lower their anger when they do get angry. I say, listen, your husband is not behaving with any ill intent, but your body does not know this. Your body feels that it's in an abusive relationship because in many ways it is, just because it's not somebody's fault necessarily, however we define moral culpability. Just because it's not coming from bad intention doesn't mean that you're not dealing with the walking on eggshells, being yelled at, you know, being told to get the hell out of your own house, not knowing which person to expect minute to minute. Your nervous system doesn't know about dementia. You know, it's just responding the way a human being would. And so I feel that part of our job, I think that in mental health, is to really give caregivers that context of what they're dealing with, because they're so in it, they don't understand oftentimes that they what they're having to put up with. And so I do think it is being in an abusive relationship where nobody is necessarily at fault, obviously, but you are in an abusive relationship. And then, you know, we were talking about memory loss, and I said that could feel deeply personal. What is memory loss if not gaslighting somebody, right? You're constantly undermining them. I didn't do that. You weren't here. How would you know this? It's this constant way of denying somebody's reality. They're not doing it on purpose. But if you're used to somebody who has a way of undercutting you in the way that abusers do, it could feel very, very similar. And it's hard not to take it personally, because that's what our minds do.
And the next, you know, logical question to all of this, or the next logical dilemma is, you know, how do I stay in this, or mm-hmm. deal with staying in this, yeah. when it is so disorienting and so frustrating? And you see why people feel like, okay, I have to get out. And it makes it particularly admirable when people stay and manage to really, I don't know, in some ways sacrifice their lives to continue to care for these folks.
Yeah. I think about that all the time. I am in awe of the sacrifices that caregivers do, but I feel like part of my job is not to romanticize their sacrifices too much, because I think that so much of how we define love is through sacrifice. And because caregivers do sacrifice so much, take Elizabeth again. She developed all kinds of medical illnesses that I truly believe she wouldn't have if she didn't suffer through it. And she was a caregiver for 18 years. Part of my job, I think, is to quietly get caregivers to a space where you're not just sacrificing, because that really affects, you know, that affects your physical and mental and cognitive health. There's a reason why caregiving is a risk for mortality or even having dementia itself. So I think that we have to be, I think part of our job is to really make sure that caregivers quietly, gently learn how to take care of themselves more and more, because so many of them just throw themselves into the sacrifice and it's so hard to recover.
Can you speak a bit about the cultural differences you've noticed amongst different caregivers, the way dementia is viewed? I particularly think of the example in the book with, I think it was a Chinese patient, but I imagine that worldwide, there are so many different perspectives on what it means to have dementia, and probably that affects the way caregivers or family members care for a significant other or their family member.
Yeah. I think that with every culture, you know, dementia doesn't just hide behind our personal histories with the person we're caring for. It also hides behind, you know, how culturally we understand diseases or how culturally we understand human behavior. So if somebody is being difficult in some cultures, we just like, oh, they're just being crazy. I think that ultimately that's how. So in terms of the culture, I think there are different, in terms of caregivers, there are different pressures of how much you sacrifice and how much you put your needs away to serve another person. So there are some cultural differences with some folks having greater, feeling a greater pressure. I mean, there's a lot of statistics, for example, for Black Americans, not only are they more likely to, twice as likely to get dementia, the caregivers put in more hours and feel a greater pressure to essentially keep it within the family, to take on all the burden themselves. And I think that this is very true in a lot of Latina cultures, in a lot of Asian cultures. It has different nuances, but I think that that's one of the things I always look out for is, well, how much is the stigma of bringing somebody in the house to help relieve me, or how much is the stigma of putting, you know, your parent in a nursing home, which has so much, which is so loaded for different cultures, to be mindful of that. And the person who has the disease, what is, you know, how are they going to, if they feel their own mind falling apart, I think they also carry around the internalized cultural stigma of what does that mean and how will people look at. There are different ways in which culture affects dementia disorders.
Interestingly, the cultures change too. You know, it's like I just look at my own kind of heritage, and back in the shtetl days, it's sort of like you all lived in the same place, and you would care for your family members. And hearing from my dad about his grandparent who was dying of colon cancer in their house, you know, his mother was sort of taking care of them. So that has changed significantly. You know, the millennials, and I imagine Gen Z, this is going to be the case as well, probably less of that kind of cultural expectation to have the ill patient in your home. And so I wonder too, to what degree that affects how we think about things these days.
That's really interesting. So if we take Julia, for example, where she was taking care of her mother, her grandmother, who's Chinese. Julia is also Chinese. I mean, she was born here, but what I think part of the heartbreak for her was that she's in between two cultures, right? She's internalized a lot of the pressure that her grandmother put on her. But at the same time, I think she's a millennial, so she understands that, like, there's such a thing as my mental health. There's such a thing as boundaries and self-care. And ironically, I think that it made things harder for her because I think that she felt like she was failing on both fronts. She felt like she was failing her grandmother, who could not, she was a bottomless pit of need and disappointment. And then she felt like, oh, she was not being this, you know, this modern woman, because she was constantly sucked back into the demands of caregiving. So I do think it'll be interesting to see how younger generations deal with it. But I think that what's very tricky is that it was just her and her grandmother. You know, generations ago, like you were saying with your family, there was a little bit more of a cushion in terms of there were cousins around, there were different people. But I think that the way that modern families go, just as raising children, it becomes a little bit more isolated. So the pressure just comes to one or two people. And that's unsustainable in many ways. And so I think that that's one of the difficulties of modern life. And I don't mean to romanticize how things were in the past, because I know that came with its own insane problems. But I think that that's part of it, is that a lot of the times these cultural expectations are very ingrained, no matter how modern or progressive we think we are. Guilt is a powerful contribution. And yet at the same time, we don't have the luxury of a support around us. So it was just Julia and her grandmother. And so it was very hard, despite the fact that she was, you know, despite the fact that she was a millennial and, you know, understood all the things that one should do for themselves and their mental health.
There's a moment where you discuss how beliefs are tied to feelings. And I think this applies to so many different areas of life, but it deeply impacts the caregiver's relationship with the patient. Can you tell us a bit more about this, the intimacy between beliefs and feelings and how it affects caring for a dementia patient?
For sure. And of course, I mean, all these things obviously touch on relationships outside of dementia, touches on our worldviews as human beings who just make sense of the world around us. Again, I think this goes back to the misconception that human beings are reasonable, even though we have that capacity. We do have bigger priorities. And I think that one of the things is that in that chapter where I mentioned that beliefs are tied to feelings, this has been this has been very big research and affect of neuroscience. We would think that if somebody has dementia, says something to us, we would know not to believe them because, you know, they have dementia. And so when Julia's grandmother would say, "You never visit me, you don't love me," you know, there was a part of me, I was so hoping that Julia would not believe her grandmother because, she, you know, we know the score, her grandmother has dementia. And that belief cost her so much of her sanity because it made her feel so guilty. Yes, intellectually, she understood that, oh, maybe I shouldn't believe her, but the beliefs are tied to feelings. So because when her grandmother said that, because her grandmother would be so angry and that emotion is so contagious, it was very hard for Julia to separate herself from her grandmother. So if her grandmother was feeling bad and punishing and was in a terrible mood, Julia couldn't get away from that guilt her grandmother always instilled in her. And she felt like a disappointment to her grandmother, even though objectively she knew all the times she visited and all those things. But to expect caregivers to not believe the person who has the disease just because they have the disease is in many ways asking too much of the caregiver because, you know, that's how we relate to human beings. Our default stance is to believe them because that's how we go about having a relationship. For Julia to constantly take everything her grandmother says with a grain of salt in some ways would be betraying that relationship and the closeness that she feels to her grandmother. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but it's very, very tricky to take people who we love or who we feel very close to and attached to with a grain of salt. When people say something, it's our default stance is to believe them. It's also how our mind makes sense of what people are saying.
Do you think there's a separate kind of process going on or separate self in a way, one that is rational or skeptical and one that is based around feelings, and then beliefs depend on the competition between those two things?
I mean, this is of course a very handy analogy, but I mean, like Daniel Kahneman's work when he talks about how, you know, in Thinking Fast and Slow, his seminal book, when he talks about system one and system two, system one of our brains is, you know, it's based on heuristics. It's based on just general, you know, cognitive biases, our emotional, our feelings, our visceral reactions. And then system two is the slower process that begins to reflect and thinks and is a little bit more skeptical. The tricky thing is that system two doesn't usually win with human beings. And it's a lot of work. It's a lot of our work for us to kind of undermine our own emotions. So for Julia to say, "No, wait a second, your grandma is just guilting you and, you know, take her with a grain of salt and don't feel that emotional pain that she's caused you your entire life. It doesn't mean anything." That takes the kind, take what she says with a grain of salt, that kind of skepticism, rationality, that slow thinking. We're all capable of it, but we're not great at it. And we're particularly not great at it when we're under stress, because that's when, as cognitive psychologists say, we do reach for those heuristics. We do reach for the familiarity of whether it's our family patterns or our cognitive kind of, our cognitive biases. It's something that we reach for when we're exhausted and depleted. And who's more exhausted and depleted than dementia caregivers? So yes, I think that in some ways there is that tension. And I talk about the system one and system two tension as being the tension of caregivers. Intellectually, they know the score, they know the disease, they know what it's doing. But viscerally, they can't help but feel all the things that caregivers feel, baited, angry, exhausted, triggered in all different kinds of ways.
What is the most moving story that you've encountered?
Oh, gosh, I'm not sure. I don't know, because I think that it's like when people ask me, like, who's the favorite case study that you wrote about? I think like anytime I'm speaking to them, that's that's the person. I don't know. I wish I had a good answer for you. I don't. They all move me because each one has a set of obstacles, familiar obstacles that they're dealing with. And when I speak to them, that to me is, in the moment, the most moving. Yeah, so I'm sorry. This is not a great answer, but I don't know. And it really varies.
You write about the caregivers as invisible victims of dementia. And I think that's a perfect way to put it. And at the end of your book, I felt a bit, I don't know, despondent. I know this isn't the purpose of the book, but what do you think that we should do as a society determined to provide dementia patients with the dignity they deserve, and then the caregivers with the dignity they deserve? And we're talking about a system that is, bending under the weight of resources and the burgeoning kind of numbers of dementia, as we talked about at the beginning. How do we even begin to sort of mitigate the difficulties of caregiving for dementia patients?
I think that big part of my book talks about the fact that we can't look at brains in isolation, that one is experiencing cognitive decline. The other one is not just passively bearing witness, that essentially this disease happens to two brains at the very least. And I think that as a society, if we need to see it as such, because right now so much of our energies are going to, spending billions of dollars trying to cure Alzheimer's. And that's a worthwhile endeavor and it's important, but I feel like we can't be naive about it. I think that the brain is, I think that people are oftentimes overly optimistic how quickly we could get at the root of this disease and fix it. And I feel like let's look at the fact that none of the medication that's come out has been particularly successful or mind-blowing. So I think that, and it's so costly, and we should continue doing that. But I think that if we put just a fraction of those resources into providing supportive programs for caregivers, then and these services have no side effects, are not very expensive, then we would be doing so much good. Because again, when one person has dementia, it becomes a health risk to the other person's brain and body. And so I feel that part of the responsibility is to make sure that we have a society where caregivers are not dealing with this alone. Because first of all, it's not sustainable. And as we know, isolation is one of the worst things we could do for our cognitive health. So how do we invest in programs that actually create support for caregivers? When I've had caregivers trying to take care of themselves, trying to get respite programs, they've had to take time off their work because it's so complicated to do it. So during the most stressful time of your life personally, you also have to navigate these Byzantine type of paperwork and bureaucracy. And it's so much work. And for most people, they oftentimes can't do it. And I think that if we only could lower that cognitive load for caregivers, if we could make it easier for them to take care of themselves, instead of saying annoyingly, oh, just take care of yourself. Self-care is important, which is one of the most annoying things for caregivers to hear, because it's like, with what time and what money and when? So I think as a society, if we invest in two brains instead of just the one that's obviously struggling, then I think that could create an enormous amount of difference, because if the numbers of caregivers are staggering. A lot of these services could be very effective for caregivers who are dealing with other neurological illnesses. We don't have to say, we don't have to separate them. These, it could work for people who are caregivers for schizophrenia or other brain disorders. But I think that we, as a culture, we're so set on curing and fixing that oftentimes the idea of supporting doesn't seem as valid. But I think that it could have a major, major difference. And again, these are people who are vulnerable to having dementia disorders in the future. So why don't we protect their brain?
Natasha, thank you so much. This has been really enlightening conversation. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much.
This podcast has been produced by the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Visit eppc.org to learn more about our programs, events, and podcasts.